Good afternoon, and thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming. We appreciate your coming to join us in our presentation. Our presentation is titled The Spiritually Vibrant Adventist Home, Center for Discipling, Nurturing, and Reclaiming. Yes. You know, sometimes when we use language such as vibrant home or spiritual home or spiritual parenting, it kind of scares people. And I wonder if maybe some people were scared as well, because for whatever reason, it's often easy for us to discuss the structure of the church, the evangelism, the stewardship. But when it comes to the home, we're a little touchy about that. We're a little fearful. It gets a little too close, if you will, to home. But what we believe is that the home has been somewhat of a missed opportunity. Yes, you know, we say the cursory things of, you know, we're going to disciple our children at home. But as we look at this today, we hope that we can begin a conversation as to how we can expand the home as a center for evangelism.
I think also in this setting, it goes without saying that we are inviting younger and younger people to lead, which is a good thing. The challenge is that they're having children here, and they're leaving those children more often than they need to be gone from them. And how do we find a balance as a world body that speaks about discipleship and retaining the people that we bring in? And we get careless sometimes with our own. I maintain that most of the people who've left the church have been our own children who were raised in this church. And imagine if we could retain the children of the church who we raised in our homes and who were baptized and who were socialized with K-Loaf and steaklets and choplets and, would stay, that the church would be twice as large as it is. So we're going to share a few things with you about that. As we share not in a vacuum, but we share in a context. And that's the context of our own home and our own family and our own children. And now a son-in-law who's just joined us here in the last 6 months. And how are we at this stage of our lives making sure that our home remains vibrant for these young adults who, while not living with us, interact with us and interface with us and see us as the face of the church, that they may want to remain in or not because of what they feel. You know, it's much more than what you know, it's what you feel. So for those of you who may not have met our family, this is my wife.
Or the wife.
I tell people it's not the wife. You know, we just came from someplace where I said she's not the wife. You know, because she's not here as a spouse. She's here as a director. You know, and we had a guest director from another division where both are directors. And again, I said no, not here as a wife. Here as a director. Anyway, so this is our family, and our family is just like your family. Our daughter is the older one, and our son, second one, and of course now we have Larry, who is Jessica's husband, Jessica, Julian, and Larry. And our prayer every day is for them, that they would remain connected to the vine, to Jesus Christ, because really nothing else matters.
Mm-hmm. So I have a question.
Okay, let me back it up.
I were to ask you, who was it that most influenced your faith? Who would you say? The person that most influenced your faith?
My dad. dad, probably.
Okay.
Your dad.
Anybody else?
Parents.
Your parents?
Your parents.
Did your father more than your mother, or your mother more than your father?
I think maybe my father.
Your
okay.
father.
Mm. All right. Anybody else?
I'd say my father and Helen influenced me.
Okay.
I don't think I've lived long enough to give them credit, but probably my parents.
Okay. All right.
That's
Thank you.
That's a powerful statement.
Yeah.
That's powerful,
yeah.
yes,
yeah.
and honest.
For me, the combination, my great-grandmother, who spent most time with me, and my mother.
Yeah.
I'm somewhat hesitant because my mother,
yeah.
I grew up Catholic, and my mother remained Catholic till, until she died.
Yeah.
So yes, she had certainly some influence, yeah.
Faith.
But then it was because she trained me to believe.
Yeah. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, I, at a certain time, I took a major step.
Right.
And that was where several things also have changed. So therefore, I was a little hesitant.
Yeah.
Mine were Baptist. I wasn't saying they were Adventist.
Yeah, we're talking about faith,
faith,
not necessarily
denomination.
Yeah.
yeah.
So thank you for sharing that.
Before you share.
Yeah. See, this is why we need 40 minutes.
Before you share, let me share, because you asked a question and I know you have a story behind it.
Yeah.
I would say my father, and both my parents are people of faith, but I would say my father. My father was a minister, and I spent a lot of time with him when I was a kid. I think that's why I'm still in the church, because while he did do quite a bit of traveling, up until the time I went to school, I was always gone with him. So, my dad.
So we could actually end the workshop right here. Because every single one of you, said a parent, a close relative, someone who raised you. Not one of you said pastor. It could have been. Maybe if we had a larger room, it might have been. Or a friend. And those people will fall in line somewhere along the life journey. But all of us were influenced in the home. And that's what we're trying to say, is that the home really is the first and probably primary place in which our faith is developed, where it's formed, where it can be nurtured, where we can develop then our loyalty to the church, because they're separate, right? Our faith commitment, our commitment to Christ is perhaps what we hope for, which is what we're talking about this weekend, is that the two will be one and the same. Our relationship with Christ and our commitment to the church. That when we say we're Seventh-day Adventists, it's synonymous to having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. But as we look at studies, we see that that's not necessarily the case.
We love this quotation by Ellen White in the Adventist Home, page 35. We can read it together. Our work for Christ is to begin with
the family
in
the
home.
There's
no missionary field more important than this. Enough said. The truth is, this is ground zero for what we do in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in terms of discipling and whether or not we're going to have a church tomorrow. Right there. Our work for Christ is to begin with the family in the home. So the question is, what are we doing in our homes? How are we, Karen Flowers, many of you know Karen, you know, they were our predecessors. Whenever I think of Karen, I think of a word she always used. They both did, but mostly Karen.
Mm-hmm.
Winsome.
Mm-hmm.
How do we develop in the home a winsome personality, a winsome approach, so our children fall in love with Jesus? Winsome. Ellen White talks about the fact that we should be friendly with our children. We should learn their ways. She did a lot of psychology without knowing.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Temperament, what have you. We have two children. One is a girl, one is a boy, and they're so different, you know. And when you have one first, you think, oh, okay. And, you know, at the time we were having children, we were trying to be non-gender specific, frankly. We didn't want them so rigidly, you know, oh, Jessica, she's a girl, she only plays with dolls, you know. She had trucks and stuff, and she climbed trees and stuff. And, you know, same with Julian as a kid. But they're so different, you know. Jessica is definitely female, and Julian is definitely male, you know. And temperament. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so.
Yeah. Well, I lost the thought. Oh.
You were listening to me too much.
Well, okay, I know what I was going to say. So I was thinking about the speaker, Brian. Yeah. Litzenberger,
yeah.
Just been so moved by his testimony. But what really struck me about his testimony on Friday night was where he said he grew up in a pretty loving Adventist home, and he was involved in Pathfinders, and he was
summer camp
mission trips, all of this. But if you've heard more about Brian's story, you begin to figure out, as I'm not sure if he was the one who said it, but there's a statement that he continuously says, which is that love was missing, right? A close, personal relationship. And so, again, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But as we go through, we want to just take a look at the types of households that we're dealing with today, because we also want to approach this from a ministry perspective. We usually have like a twofold presentation, in that we want you to internalize it personally for yourselves, your own families, your own homes, your own circumstances, but also from a ministry perspective. So if we're doing ministry, we need to recognize that there are all kinds of households now. And you all know this. We're speaking to the choir. We have the nuclear family. We have single parent families. Extended family. I grew up in an extended family and a multi-generational family. I was raised by my grandmother. My mother worked 24/7, so my grandmother was the one who mostly influenced me in my home. And we see a lot of this happening now, especially as our economic situation is somewhat bleak, and we see families living together. Like, even in our neighborhood, we have, in some of our homes, much to the chagrin of the families who prefer nuclear families, there are three families living in one house. The parents buy the house, and the two kids, the two sons, will bring their wives, and they all live in one house, and they share the mortgage together, and that way it helps to alleviate the financial stress. So we see that happening. We have the empty nesters.
That's us.
And this is an important one, but anyway. And then you have single adults living alone or with housemates. That's a household. And that's an often ignored household as we're doing ministry. Right, Allie? You know, we're looking around, we're talking about family, but we're not talking about the household that looks like this. And we have a lot of these people in our churches, kids who are displaced from their homes, who are here for school or work assignments, and they get lost in our congregation. So we need to be cognizant of that. Cohabiting couples, yes, people of God, we have cohabiting couples in our churches. We do premarital, and I can tell you that when we do an inventory, we administer an inventory before the couple comes to us. We say, we need you to fill out this inventory, so that we can get an assessment of you know, who you are as a couple, so that we can help you. And I would say now about 50% of the couples who've come to us are living together.
50. Yes.
Yes.
Church members.
Involved.
Sabbath school teachers.
Teaching Sabbath school, Pathfinder leaders. Yeah. They're living together. That's what's happening in society. They rationalize. They say, look, we're saving money. You know, it's going to be cheaper for us. Why should we have two different places? And because the society is so powerful, on the one hand, they're uncomfortable with it, but because most people are not confronting them, because in church we don't talk about cohabiting couples, so they don't have to feel guilty. But what's interesting is that as soon as we mention it, then the tears flow. Like, we know we shouldn't be living that way. But we kind of just think that in our churches, well, everybody's perfect. You got baptized, so you're good, you know? same-sex couples. Yes. And we have them in our churches, and we hear from them all the time. I think there's not a week that goes by that we don't get a letter from LGBT people in the church. Maybe not coupled, because they're, you know, usually one from the church, one not from the church, but they're there, and they're coming to church, and they want to be Adventist. So we're not justifying any of these, but we're saying this is, these are the households, these are the people that we're ministering to.
So here are some of the trends in the 21st century, and we're going to have to put a speed on it, because we have just a few more minutes. Boomerang kids, and you know what that is, kids who go away to school and then they come back, you know, and you thought they were going to get a career and go off and get a job, and sometimes they're not quite with a job yet, and they come and they hang out, and you know, I don't know. Let me share the story.
The Pellegrino.
No, let me share the story. So you know, just a few years ago, when our son came back from grad school, you know, he had done an undergraduate degree in engineering, civil and environmental, and went on to grad school to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he did a master's in environmental engineering, and then. I mean, he's a high-powered degrees, right? I mean, he should have enough to go off, you know.
Yeah, anyway, like, you should be taking care of us now.
Anyway, he came back. He worked here with ADRA for a year. And before he got that job with ADRA, because he went off to Kenya to do research with the university and World Vision. And he came home, and I think it was the third week he was home. And Elaine came home from work one day. And he was in his pajamas. You know, it was in the afternoon, or late afternoon.
Eating my food.
And Elaine said to him,
drinking my Pellegrino.
Did you make any calls today that you, you know? He said, Mom.
He said he's tired.
Chillax, you know. He said, chillax, you know, just take it down. He says, what's all this animus for? She says, when I graduated from college, he's graduated from graduate school. When I graduated from college, Elaine says, I was beating the pavement, you know, every day, making sure that I could find a job. He says to his mother, Mom, when you graduated from college, you didn't live in a house like this.
Well, that was like one of those bang zoom moments. But, you know, then we had to think about this workshop. No.
Anyway, so boomerang kids, millennials delaying marriage and family, you know, millennials delaying marriage and family, urban family, and we'll talk a little bit more about post-Christian culture, declining church attendance, do-it-yourself faith formation. Oops, let's bring that back. I'm sorry. All right.
Yeah, so well, as you're doing that, so urban family is what we've heard some young adults describe as they move to a city and their family becomes their housemates or their friends that they socialize with. That becomes their family unit. And when we look at these trends and we're talking about people leaving the church, just look at all of these things and you can see, you know, even as Willie tells his story, I mean, this was a tough one for us, you know, to really be Christ-like, because to come home to your house every day, we're just being transparent. And we're saying, look, we paid money, you went to school, now you have education, go get a job, you know? And those relationships can get very strained. And again, our kids are always looking for Jesus. Yeah. And even more heightened for those of us who are in ministry. You know, am I seeing Jesus in you? But this is what, these two things, these last three things are really critical that we're up against. Post-Christian culture, and we're again looking at research where we're saying we're losing young adults between the college age. I would dare say, as I look at some research, we lost them, first of all, when they were already in high school.
Right.
They waited till they were 18
right.
to leave. And then after college, their heads are filled with all this knowledge and they've seen the world now, at least they think they have. And then they're exposed to this. Uh-huh. And Then they start making decisions like, well, you know what, I'm still Adventist, but I go to church once a week, maybe Wednesday night. I go to church once a month. And it's more than my Catholic friends. I mean, they go once a year, right? Or maybe I drop in every few months when there's a special program to reclaim the lost.
Because I'm still tired, you know, from college and what have you, and so I'm still trying to catch up with sleep.
That's right. And it just
and the Sabbath,
work.
After all, is a day of rest. And God wants me to relax and rest and enjoy. So, I mean, this church stuff.
Yeah, we're just sharing with you what we hear. And that do-it-yourself faith, you don't have to go back. Yeah. That's like, let me see. You say that God says that we should keep the Sabbath. Let me see what Wikipedia says. Let me see what my friend's podcast has to say. Mm-hmm. And it's not just kids. They're adults doing this. Okay, so we're excited about this research that the Barna Group just did on 2,000 Christian households to discover how faith is nurtured within households. And what it looked at was the practicing faith of Christians, of Christian homes. Perhaps there were some Adventists in there, but we've often used Barna because he has done lots of research,
church
and it
groups.
Does closely reflect. As we do our own research, we see some parallels. In fact, as we talk about this, as we looked at this research, one of the reasons why we were moved by it is because it brought us back to what Value Genesis said 5, 10, 15 years ago. So there was a lot of data that emerged in the research that was very similar to what Value Genesis was saying. So what they identified was that there were four distinct profiles of spiritual vibrancy or lack of vibrancy. And so they saw that there were a significant portion of homes that were dormant. These households, they're just going along life. These are Christians. These people identified themselves as Christians, Christian households from the census. These households do not talk about God or faith together. They don't pray together. They don't read the Bible together regularly. And they don't welcome non-family visitors regularly. Those are the dormant. Then you have the hospitable. These households welcome non-family visitors several times a week.
A month.
And they might participate in some spiritual activities, but not all of them regularly. So that was like Hezekiah. Remember Hezekiah? He, you know, had that wonderful experience being saved by God, and then instead of showing people what God had done, he showed them his house. He was very hospitable, and he was saved. So, you know, he was a good Christian, but he brought people to his home, and he thought it was more important to show them his secrets. Devotional. They talk about God or faith together. They pray together. They read the Bible together regularly, but they do not welcome non-family visitors at least several times a week. Do you see where this is going? A month. Then we have the spiritually vibrant, and this is what they do. They talk about God, just like the devotional. They pray together. They read the Bible together regularly, but they welcome non-family visitors several times a month. This is our second end to our workshop, that we could end it here. Because we're talking about nurturing and
retaining,
and what else? Discipling, and all of that. And the home can be that center. And what they're saying is that the people who showed strong faith development, strong denominational loyalty to their own faith, their own denomination, they were inviting non-family visitors several times a month to their home.
So there were, in fact, modeling hospitality. And it's that hospitality, that caring, that love, that conveys the love of Jesus. Not only to the people who are coming, but to the kids who live in this home. That my parents are not only talking about God, they are living the gospel. They are genuine about what God is saying and about what God expects of us. And that's a big difference. That's what the research says, that hospitable families tend to be the vibrant homes and tend to be the ones that keep their kids in the church, because they feel, they don't only know, they feel. When we travel around the world in our work for the church, I could think of, I'm not going to call any region of the world, I'm just thinking of a region in the world where we've been told several times, you know, the Seventh-day Adventist Church is a wonderful faith, and we're happy to be Seventh-day Adventists, but it's a head religion. You know, it's not so much a heart religion. You know, we know about the Sabbath, we know about not eating pork, we know about not drinking whiskey or what have you. But, you know, if our kids get sick or something, well, I'm not going to say the rest of that because then you're going to know where I'm talking about. But so when we're talking about a spiritually vibrant home, we're talking about a home that lives the gospel. And that living of the gospel gets communicated by being hospitable, by bringing people home. I didn't know this until we saw the Barna study, but I grew up in that kind of home. That's why I'm still in the church. You know, not only did we bring home people for lunch on Sabbath, there were people at my home on Wednesday, on Thursday, on Monday.
In fact, when his father died and we went to the house, we arrived at the house, and there were all these people hugging Willie. And, you know, and they're saying, you know, man, your father was like a father to me. And Willie's, and they're hugging him because they feel like they're his brother. You know, they feel close. And he's like, I don't know any of these people, you know. And it was just so beautiful to watch. There were all these people who said, you know, man, it's because of you and your father that I'm still in church. To this day, we still travel around the world. His father was a missionary in Central America. And we still travel around. And every time he gets up to preach, somebody will come up afterwards, or a few people, and say, your dad baptized me.
Yeah.
But not only did he baptize me, and we're going to talk about that in the study, he cared about me. And so there's some important things to this vibrancy, the talking about God or faith together. So again, Brian mentioned this on Friday night in his testimony. He happens to be here now. I've been invoking your name here. And he said that when he was 15, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, he started having questions that nobody could answer. How many times have your kids asked you questions and you just got Ellen White, you know, or the Bible.
Well, here's what scripture says.
Or even some wonderful new textbook that talks about the reconciliation of faith and reason, you know, and you try to sit down with this kid and rationalize with them why they should love God or why they should remain in the church. Or how many times did you totally just resist their question and say, you're asking too many questions? Yeah. Just love God.
Yeah.
You know, just pray a little bit more. Just read your Bible. You know, you're not praying enough.
You're not studying your Sabbath school lesson.
Or are our conversations just to the extent of, did you study your Sabbath school lesson this week? Did you have worship? So all these close-ended questions that we ask our kids. And then we also speak to parents who tell us, it's personal. I don't talk to my kids about faith. That's the private sphere. So again, our conversations about faith are not really about faith. Our prayer together is not praying about what's really happening in our lives. It's a cursory obligation that we do together. And so those things are important. So the key findings of Barna's study, the presence of children and minors served as a catalyst for vibrancy. So when we have small children, they notice families are a lot more vibrant, of course, because they're more engaged. They want to take their kids to Sabbath school, Pathfinders, or, you know, you have family worship. So that serves as a catalyst. And so the empty nest people were at risk.
Yeah.
Do any of you have friends who have left the church in their older age? I have friends who, like, I'm thinking, you got through midlife crisis. Like, what in the world?
I mean, you got through teenagers. You got through young adults, you know, I mean.
But empty nest is a risk period for households where there are no children. So I often see Dr. Simmons. You have your grandchildren with you.
A lot
in the summer.
Yeah.
And so that adds to the vibrancy of the home. So we're kind
not
of
inspiring.
If you feel you have to have worship, you know, because
if
you don't have them there, you know, it's easy to forget.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Faith, but that does not preclude us then. So you know, we're now including just the implications. As if we're empty nesters, find some kids. Again, there are people, there are families in your church.
I mean, you could have worship with each other as well, you know.
Yes, you can have worship with each other, but we're talking about adding the hospitality piece. Faith formation is connected to and increases with hospitality. That was one of their key findings. Spiritually vibrant homes are characterized by fun and quality time. So this was also very important, that the people who felt strong in their faith said that in our homes growing up, it wasn't just Bible study. There was singing that, you know, we played games together. We had fun together.
Exhibit A. That's why I'm here. My dad was big on fun and having games and going on picnics and playing board games and doing stuff.
What else do you have? Faith heritage impacts Christian beliefs and practices for the long term. So we have to share our stories with our children. I started talking about my grandmother who raised me, and she really was the person who most influenced me for several reasons. One, she really believed the Bible. Like, she took it literally. So this whole making disciples thing was very important to her. My grandmother would try to baptize the Sears repairman. The guy would come to fix the washing machine, and before he got to see the washing machine, she offered him a cup of tea. So she didn't just start with the Bible. You know, she said, you know, my brother, it looks like you've had a long day. You know, and for, I guess she was intentional. Her appointments were like in the afternoon. And then she always cooked. The kitchen always smelled like baked goods. And so, of course, once you sat down for a cup of tea, you needed a scone or a muffin or something. So you're sitting there. I'm thinking, how did these guys have the time? Then, for whatever reason, the machine probably didn't get fixed. I just remember one Sears guy that was at my house, like, every week for a month. And then next thing I know, she's giving the guy Bible studies. And she was so intentional about talking about her journey, her experience, how God blessed her. You know, she talks about coming from poverty and having a nervous breakdown and how the Lord brought her out of that. So I grew up hearing these stories of faith and believing them and believing that God could make a difference in my life personally. So we have to share our journey, our struggle with our kids. The problem is that too often in church, everyone's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, our kids think we are.
Right.
If we don't really say, you know, sometimes I feel like you're feeling, you know. Kid says, you know, I'm not sure I believe this stuff. And you know, come on. How about fessing up and saying, you know, I'm not always sure myself.
You know what that reminds me of? There's a children's poet, Shel Silverstein. And there's a book, it's called A Light in the Attic, and we used to read it to our kids, and there was a little poem in there where the little boy is speaking to an old man.
Yeah.
And, okay, I hope I can say this here, but the little boy says, you know, sometimes I pee my pants, and the old man says, sometimes I do too. All right, so the spiritually vibrant home has meaningful, fun, and quality time with family members or housemates, in addition to people from outside of the household. We have to care about people. We have to love people. We have to make the time for people. So we're making time for our family members, but we're expanding our household to invite other people. Do you know how many people on Sabbaths have nowhere to go? Do you know how many people on a Tuesday evening? Again, my family to this day, my grandmother's now dead for 10 years, but my mother and her sisters have continued the legacy. Every time I go home to my house, there's some new family member that's calling me cousin. I just call them all cousin. And you know what they do? It scares me sometimes. They're in their 70s and their 80s, but they're young families at the church, and they've become grandparents to these families. So there are these young couples who, one I can think of that's very close to the family right now, they both are engineers, have very demanding jobs, And my aunts will go pick their kids up after school. They'll take them to piano lesson. They'll take them to, you know, to the market, to the flower shop, or and have worship with them, give them supper. So that's not a Bible study. You know, do you get what I'm trying to say? Like, sometimes when I hear these evangelistic things, it's like, let's look at the strategic. Hopefully we got out of that this time around, right? And the plans and the training and all of that.
Not that that's bad.
And all of that is good, but you could be doing this. And we could be preserving people. There are couples who are struggling in our churches. Their marriages are on the brink. And all they need is a mentor couple to say, look, you know what, we argue sometimes too about stupidness.
Oh, we say that all the time. In fact, just 2 weeks ago or so, we were at birthday dinner on a Saturday night with church members, and there was a couple sitting across from us, and she said something. She had a very happy face, and she said something to her husband, and I leaned over and I said, I love the way you guys do that. She says, what? I said, I love the way how you look so agreeable disagreeing. So she says, oh, you have no idea, she said. I said, well, you know, we still disagree about stuff. She says, oh, don't tell me that.
I know, like we've arrived, you know.
I said, there's no plateau. I said, in marriage, you don't arrive. I said, you're always growing and disagreeing about stuff and learning new things.
Sometimes you're two different people.
And having an opportunity to work through it, I said. It's not about being perfect. I said, there are no perfect marriages because there are no perfect people. Mm-hmm. What we need is commitment, and commitment to love, commitment to be gracious, commitment to be kind. And that, if nothing else, is what we need in the Seventh-day Adventist Church for discipleship, for nurturing, for retention. People stay where they feel loved. People stay where they feel they belong to the family.
So we have 4 minutes.
All right.
Or three. Okay. So spiritually vibrant home differs from devotional and hospitable households in that they combine both devotional and hospitable attributes. So I don't want any of the leaders or pastors to think we're saying we should do away with the devotional. You understand that. We're just saying we need to add hospitality. It's intentional about sharing faith, activities, feelings, and spiritual conversations. And the spiritual conversations are so important, and we've got to figure out how to have meaningful spiritual conversations with our children. We engage in spiritual coaching.
And part of that coaching is exactly what I just said a little while ago. If your 15-year-old says, you know, I'm not sure I believe in this stuff, good coaching might be, sometimes I have doubt to myself. That's good coaching. That's saying, hey, we're on a journey. We could pray about this. Let's pray and ask God to help us to get some clarification on what's going on and what our doubts are about. So here's what Ellen White says here. What does a spiritually vibrant home look like? She says, let's read it together. The atmosphere surrounding the souls of the fathers and mothers
who are guardians
fills the whole house
and is felt in every department of the home.
You have to feel it. It has to be there.
So how does a spiritually vibrant home contribute to discipling, nurturing, and reclaiming? It's a place for faith formation and development. It's a place where we pass on faith and a spiritual legacy. There's hospitality in a spiritually vibrant home. We wanted to look real closely at this. We saw this slide this morning by David. This was 2014 because they didn't have the latest research up when we prepared our workshop, but it's still close enough. This is a profile of the members who left the SDA Church as of the 2014 study. And if you look here, 63% of the people were having family worship. So, you know, what does that say to you? Again, family worship by itself is not going to save us. We need to do it, but it's not the only thing. Only 42% were church observers. That means that a large percentage were involved in church. As we said before, kids were involved in Pathfinders and mission trips and all of that. But what we are really intrigued with is that the marriage and family issues and the conflict with church members, that's 50-something percent of relationship issues. Okay, we've said it enough today that it's about relationship. And the 62% that said if they got called, they would come back. Can we call somebody? Implications of the research. Our family is our first mission field. People inside our congregations are longing for intimate connections. That's why they come. There's a vast opportunity for us to reach people through our own family life. People want to feel connected. We must make our homes spiritually vibrant. Mm.